Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the What Culture Gaming Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Tilford, joined by Rich Hutton.
Hello.
And Jules Gill.
Hey, guys.
How are we all feeling? Because right now, Jules has come back from America. I've been trying to beat the final boss of Sekiro. Rich is moving house. There's a lot of fatigue in the room.
I think collectively we might make half a human. But as you can tell, I've got a bit of a tongue ulcer, so apologies if I sound a little bit like I'm mutating.
We might make a FromSoft boss. We've become our own worst enemies. So all the stuff that's happened this week, there's a whole bunch of exposés came out from Kotaku. We've already covered them on the channel. You can watch like me and Josh's thoughts on it as those things were breaking. But it just seems to be bringing out this overall, or highlighting the general sort of disconnect between artistic creative freedoms and the creative side versus the corporate whims of the biggest companies in the industry right now. And I think I just want to pose the question, why do you guys think that developers and publishers don't make exactly what fans want?
Because unfortunately they are catering to what some fans want, and those some fans happen to be the ones that actually spend money. Money talks at the end of the day, and creative freedom is, I'd say, it's a right of every human being, and especially it's one that is pursued quite heavily within the video games industry. But at the end of the day, if it doesn't make bank, you're not going to stay around. And I'm really sorry to say that. I mean, how many independent games have we seen that look so interesting but just haven't got the funding or the support behind them? And it's meant that those people have not had their dreams shared. Whereas the most paint-by-numbers shooters and platformers and racing games, they will stay in the public mainstream because they make money, because they scratch that particular itch.
Yeah, that's the thing that, like, obviously EA would back up, and that was the comments that, like, EA's, like, top brass had said to Amy Hennig when she was trying to get her Star Wars project over the line, was like, you know, FIFA's Ultimate Team makes, like, X many million a year, like, where's your version of that? And she's like, well, that's just not what we're making. And it's like, well, if that's the that's the argument. I mean, this is all just a wider conversation. It's not meant to draw conclusions, but, like, if you go down that thought process, then, you know, why they could just make something that's entirely money-hungry and entirely money-focused. And as we found out this week, like, EA mandate games as a service and recurrent spending methods, so it seems like that's the direction they're going.
I mean, I feel like it's a real shame, because I feel like the industry at the moment has not catered for the creative individual, and I feel like it used to. I feel like before, you'd find a lot of independent game houses that had platforms like Microsoft's Independent Store and things like that. They would launch and get support that way, or at least have the backing from Microsoft themselves. And nowadays it seems like they're hedging their bets on a few big franchises and not taking as many risks, as it were, developing new IPs. I mean, it's why we're seeing so many reboots. It's why we're seeing stuff that's cemented in franchises that have already made it.
Yeah.
But that's not future-proofing the industry. In fact, you did a huge deep dive on it, the fact that the video game industry might be heading for its own collapse based on the weight of expectations that it's built for itself.
And you're seeing a lot of like the weird fallout, because obviously gaming is bigger than ever right now, and the amount of money that gets like passed back and forth between developers, publishers, and whatever is just astronomical figures. So they're always trying to like deliver on that. And it's like the amount of time that these games take to put together, the amount of different trends they have to encapsulate, or like the amount of different visions, that things that change over the years. Like Anthem was in development pretty much since 2013 or whatever, and it changed from being like a Dark Souls survival type game to this big old like loot shooter, just Johnny Generic type thing, grind type thing. Obviously the return on investment, I mean, it's sold like actually surprisingly well,
but it's not BioWare's name behind it more than anything else, really.
And the fact that it's just like you can't just grab some friends and shoot some stuff and get some loot, which is kind of what the Division's coasting on. But then that's the thing, is that it highlights that sort of of spreadsheet game design approach, which Anthem just became over time as their sort of focus was so disparate. And they're like, okay, we can lock these elements down. But The Division is just trying to be a playable spreadsheet.
But don't get me wrong. I mean, it sounds like that's a criticism. If anything, that's an incredibly clever piece of marketing. What they've done is, like, while we can sit here and say it's not the best game and it's not going to win any sort of like narrative awards and things like that, there are still clearly enough people who want to play this game. Mm-hmm. So it's catering for a market that exists. It would be foolish for us to sit here and say that it's the wrong move for a company to make.
No, that's the crux of the thing. Yeah.
But it possibly is the wrong move for the creativity of the industry to keep making these cookie cutter games.
Yeah.
I think it's a balancing issue. Mm. Ah, games.
Nice.
But
nerds.
Because, like you say, devs are making all these games, or publishers are wanting all these games made, but they're not necessarily going to be backing it up with those like first party, third party, single player, as an example, experiences that are going to be more creatively interesting. Like, you take God of War from last year. Yes, it's a reboot. Yes, it's an existing franchise, but it feels like they really did something with it. They had that indie game mentality with it. And I think that's the problem we've got. That's why, like, all of Ubisoft's stuff it all seems so run-of-the-mill, because it's all just the same formula repeated over and over and over again. It's like, you have that formula. That's fine. Do that with The Division. But take things like Far Cry. Take things like, Splinter Cell and whatever else, and do something with it. Do something interesting with it.
Mm-hmm. What's interesting to note is the fact that there's a mentality of the companies that actually... some of them share it and some of them don't. There's a AAA mentality in the likes of EA where they do basically put the money first and then maybe the customer experience second, obviously partitioning off games to be sold as DLC and things like that. But you look at, say, companies like Yacht Club and you look at...
Love Yacht Club.
Like, the Rocket League guys who made that.
Psyonix.
And then you look at... what's another huge indie game that was big? Like Super Meat Boy.
I was going to say Team Meat,
Team Meat did, obviously, Binding of Isaac as well. Like, those games there have continued to grow in success and size, yet they've always maintained a independent game mentality, which is DLC, if it does come out, is usually free. I mean, look at CD Projekt Red with The Witcher.
Yeah, like Shovel Knight.
They get to a size where they are huge and can now be considered as potentially AAA titles in terms of experience and content, but their mentality of the monetary gain isn't the same as approach as EA has. And I am singling out EA. It's just because it's the current...
EA and Activision are the two go-to as the most... they exemplify the corporate interest, the corporate mentality, even though you can, on EA's side, hold up something like their EA Originals program that still greenlights indie projects.
I said the other day, I genuinely think EA are starting to turn themselves around a bit. Mm. Like, I think that obviously with Anthem, they've still like put their foot in it a bit, but like with the fact that they're doing the Originals, with the fact that obviously DICE managed to get Battlefield 5 through, as much as it hasn't really done as well, but it's gone. They've said, we're going to take away all the stuff that bloated Battlefield 1. We're going to get rid of the stuff that you would expect from us from EA. And I kind of think they're turning things around. I don't think it'll be gone forever, but maybe they're striding into doing that balancing to make it so they are, they've got their loot stuff that people enjoy. Like, I personally don't understand. I don't enjoy the loot grind shooting stuff. But like, I know, as you said, there are people out there that like that. Mm. They're going to cater for that, but then they should also cater for the other people. And they are starting to do that with things like A Way Out, with things like the Originals. They're really... genuinely trying, and I've got to give them credit for that.
I think it's just, like I said, I think it's like a small part of their overall reach or whatever, but it is good to see. Something like A Way Out wouldn't even exist, and that game has one of the only original mechanics at all in gaming for the last like half decade.
What, the dual control thing?
It mandates a split screen. You have to play it split screen, it's recommended you play it as a local co-op game, and like our couch co-op, and like just nothing else is like that. Brothers, like the same studio, mandated that you play it with like two characters, but it's on one controller with an analog.
That's a phenomenal game.
Yeah, and it's like that thing where that was EA putting the money behind that. So it's like at least some of their like financial wing at least wants to try and highlight those ideas. Things,
actually, this is something we can sell on the fact that it's a game, not something we could then bloat.
But it's almost to me like that particular thing, like the perception of that, the optics of it, like in a business sense, is like it's the big corporate company going, oh, but we're still planting flowers. We're still sort of like, we care about the environment as their oils.
One tree.
as their like factories burn in the background. And so there's all that. But I think like, I don't know if you think that like you were saying before about like the, in the past you would see like a wider variety of risks being taken. Like I feel like the 2000s gaming industry
was what the whole industry was. The 1970s, 1980s. It was just risks. Because I mean, you talk about the crash of 83, you talk about the entirety of like the first gen of consoles and what came before that. That was all based on just potential, not mm-hmm. on specifics. And I think that's what happened with like current AAA stuff, is those specifics, they are blowing way out of proportion. Hence why when they turn around and say, hey, we only made 4 billion last year, we wanted 5 billion.
Yeah, because it's been in development.
So I think I would be fine with like a quarter of that money.
Yeah,
you.
Of course.
I mean, this is the thing. I'm always with that mentality, which is like, it's not up to me, the consumer, to pay the costs of the developer. If you, the developer, choose to make your graphics cost you $15 million to animate a duck or something like that, like, that's not to me to have to help you recruit.
Yeah,
that
hell of a duck.
You know what I mean? Yeah, yes. Hell of a duck. But it's like, I'm just saying, like, that's why I sometimes prefer the indie game mentality, because you see those cheery little sprites, you see that real hand-drawn animation techniques that go into it, love in a different way, that cost time, maybe not money. And I think I prefer that than somebody going, here's a photorealistic, you know, duck leaf pond. I don't know why I've gone for ducks again,
but because that's the whole thing, is they'll spend so much money on arbitrary stuff that doesn't really matter to the crux of why you're playing that game, but it gives it that whole AAA look. That was the team behind Hellblade. I completely forget their name.
Ninja Theory.
That whole thing. I was thinking Team Ninja, but that's dead or alive.
Yeah.
Ninja Theory wanted to prove that you could do a AAA looking game on a modest indie budget, which is what Hellblade was. And it was tackling that idea that, like, what does the average consumer look for? Will they respond to something like that? And it did make it some money back. And it was a successful project.
I mean, it's down to the engines you use as well. Because, I mean, we were talking just before we came on to the podcast that EA are mandating that every sort of project that they're working on uses the Frostbite engine.
Yeah. For now. I think that'll go away in the next couple of years.
But that actually hampers you, because while you're saying to yourself, yeah, I'm recouping my losses of investment because I'm actually using this product on every single project that I'm working on, you're actually hampering the development of said engine, because you're saying, right, everyone's using the same one. Once you pushed it to its limits, where do you take it? And you get games that end up looking homogenous.
Well, the report on Anthem's side was like, if they wanted to just try a new lightning model, it would take a whole day to like, quote unquote, bake that in, as they call it, in the dev team, to see what that looked like the next day. That was the thing that also hampered on Destiny's side, just the tech they were working with. They couldn't actually see. It's like deleting a word in a document, and it taking a day to see the new sentence.
They said, didn't they, that with Anthem in particular, that they had to test a lot of the air quotes online functionality offline which meant that they couldn't understand how the marketplace for an online thing would work.
Yeah.
So they had to guess, which means that explains why we have the loot rates being so incredibly low.
They'd be changed so much,
and stuff, because you wouldn't be able to test it properly with a player base that's active.
Yeah. It's just putting a developer out of their depth, basically. Because, like, you know, games switch engines all the time. As an example, like Wolfenstein The New Order and Wolfenstein 2, they switched engines. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know what the engine was for the first one, but the second one was based on the Doom engine for 2016.
Mm-hmm.
And they did feel different. It played a damn sight better.
Yeah.
That's fine. But when, like, as EA is an example, who are pushing Frostbite on everyone. Not to say that Frostbite is a bad engine.
No, look at
Battlefield
5. It can, well, yeah. It is. Anything first person? Brilliant.
Absolutely stunning. I mean, it really threw me when they said, oh, FIFA's running on Frostbite now. And I'm thinking, what?
I know. That was like a weird thing they made happen.
Respawn, obviously, a subsidiary of EA, of Infinity War people, obviously, they used to use called the IW engine or whatever they call it every year with COD. When they change it, they Frankenstein it.
Yeah.
You know? But when they moved over to EA, they use Source, which is Valve's engine that was introduced in 2003.
Mm-hmm.
They've been using that for Titanfall 1 and 2 and Apex. So they've been used, I mean, when did the split happen? It must have been 2011?
Yeah.
It was Modern Warfare 3 kind of time.
Sure.
So, you know, like, that was a long time ago. 7, 8 years ago.
So. My life before Sekiro is a blur. Yeah. But yeah.
So using Source, they've been doing it for so long. And if they suddenly turn around and go, hey, okay, here's a new engine, you've got to use it now. Sorry. it's like, for example, in the What Culture Office, they turn around and go, okay, all of you use Premiere. You're all going to use Avid now.
You can use iMovie.
You can all use iMovie. And they go,
oh God.
Okay, it's like all of you, like you were using a PC instead of a Mac.
Yeah, totally.
It's that same kind of thing. It just throws everything out of balance. And I understand wanting to keep everything in-house. Like, hey, look, we can market the hell out of the fact that it's on Frostbite, which they already do, quite rightly so. But it can just throw things completely out of whack and make games that just don't work.
Yeah.
It's why when they were coming to do the driving sections of, I can't remember which game, they went back to Criterion, who were the makers of...
Andromeda, yeah.
Yeah, so that they went back to them to basically say, like, look, we know you have a pedigree in racing. Can you come and help us with this?
Mm-hmm.
All because of the fact that team who was working on it didn't have a clue how to make that racing and driving structure
feel remotely in their
game.
Well, it's like how id Software doing Rage, you've got Avalanche in to do the driving Rage because they don't know how to do it.
But at least,
and
I mean,
they did Just Cause series and the driving, and that's fantastic.
Yeah,
yeah, so. And don't get me wrong, like most of the time when they call in somebody, it's actually the best possible thing. That tag teaming on a project like that can result in some fantastic stuff. Like, I can't remember who it was, but they brought in a company to do a multiplayer element of I believe it was Bioshock 2. And I just remember that being one of the better things about the entire game.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think all of it like speaks to, like, to bring it back around to that whole, like, the way that the sort of, like, you know, the corporate aspects of gaming, the whole, like, you've got a deadline, you work to this, this is the spec of the general project, the thing that you're aiming for. Like, how much do we think that, like, games need that overarching, you know, creative force behind it? Like, God of War has Corey Barlog, and he was there from beginning to end. Anthem started with Casey Hudson, and then he left, and it all fell apart.
I'm just saying, like, the argument now of our video games art. It totally is. But it's, you need to treat them as such, because good films have great directors. Mm-hmm. Great games have fantastic directors as well. I mean, like, as much as he's disappeared up his own backside, Hideo Kojima is a fantastic
he
director.
He lives up there, and I love it.
Because he gets what he wants in his games. And I feel like that's what the fans resonate with. If you find a project that doesn't have a creative voice, or in the case of Peter Molyneux, has too much
your favorite
creative,
friend.
One day I'm going to meet him. One day I'm going to meet him, and I'm going to shake his hand.
You're going to
be like, I forgive you, Peter. And he's not going to have a clue. He won't have a clue what I'm on about.
As he works on God is 5.
Or he'll have some sort of like, the game will be on a seed and you grow the game itself, according to
the
him.
Game is the tree, yeah, and you finally plant it. That's a great thing to drill down on, though, because we've kind of lost that sense of authorship over in this modern decade. Like, you know, Ken Levine, like, obviously he stepped away from Bioshock and what do you call it, his team that he was with?
Irrational
Games. And it's like, you know, Hideo Kojima is one of the, and Corey Barlog now are like, you know, a handful of auteurs we can point to.
Actually, let's try and list the top ones in the industry at the
right
moment.
Right now.
So Hideo Kojima is still going, because obviously Death Stranding. We've got Cliff Blazing. Is he?
Nah.
Cliffy B is retired
for now.
Restaurants and stuff now.
Done with the industry for now. Like, that's the thing. It's like, you try to, like, find a specific figure that you can point to and go, okay, it's their creative vision. I don't necessarily think it should have to be, but it definitely helps.
The guy from FromSoft with...
Hideo Miyazaki.
Like, I'd say that...
You felt his loss in Dark Souls 2.
Unbelievably so. Yeah. But that's a perfect example of what we're talking about. Like, having a game with a clear creative voice and then losing it, it's so apparent.
Yeah.
Like,
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promote for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Because it's like, you nearly, like, I mean, one of the things that the Kotaku expose is pointed to is, if you're on those teams, on those creative teams, you're on the coding side or the art direction or whatever it is, the concept side, and you're trying to, like, bring this vision together, if you don't have, like, a mastermind, a go-to visionary to, you know, sort of bounce stuff off, like, as much as you can point to EA in terms of mandating Frostbite and whatever in Anthem's case, reading the expose, it was a lot of BioWare's leadership. They had a 3-person leadership team who weren't Casey Hudson and weren't the people who started the project, and they were just trying to do their best, but if they didn't have a vision, they don't have anything to go back to. Whereas in God of War's case, they always had Casey Hudson to bounce back off, and in Death Stranding's case, they'll always have Kojima. So maybe one of the reasons that we saw, you know, a creative artistic direction across the 2000s is because we had more auteurs leading everything.
Don't get me wrong, it doesn't mean that all of those games are great.
No, of course.
But it just means that at least they were mildly consistent across the board.
Because it's not very often you look at, like, a film, for example, that has more than two directors.
Two directors is
occasional, but usually it's only one person.
True.
And it's like, there's an identity thing with gaming now, like, because, like, we know of Corey Barlog and we love him. We just want to hug him. And it's
good
like, we know who he is. We just know what he looks like. Yeah. We know him. And losing that, I think, as you said, that is something that plagues games. Mm-hmm.
Do you know what it is? It's putting a face to a video game actually helps with consumer trust. I swear. I mean, you actually find some people love and hate games based off of who the personality is who's actually behind it. I found lots of people who really disliked Fallout 76, not because necessarily of the game, but because of what Todd Howard promised and didn't deliver. Like,
Did Sean Murray in No Man's Sky?
You accept the responsibility of that if you are the figurehead, but I do feel like it steers a game in the direction that can be incredibly marketable. Mm. You know,
but I think
even with like top tier like AAA publishers, they have that. Like you've got what's his face from Ubisoft,
Yves Guillemot.
Yes, uh-huh. like he's a guy who comes out at E3. He's always there. You've got
Shigeru Miyamoto.
You've got Reggie. I mean, not RIP, but
I wish we still had Reggie. Reggie IP.
Andrew Wilson, the comic book supervillain.
He's the opposite, but he's a nice guy.
He's a face. And then it's like when you read reports about Activision, like I don't know what the guy who runs Activision's name is, but he's like, oh, here's his like $4 billion like paycheck.
Yeah.
And you see a picture of him and it's like, I've got no idea who you are.
Yeah.
Like, but it's literally about as faceless as you can get.
But that shift though, you can literally go like, I mean, it is like a more like, you know, like you said, like you put an identity to the game even before it's out and across the pre-release materials and stuff. And that shift over time as the industry's gotten bigger calls for a need for people like Andrew Wilson, who he'll be regarded as one of the best business people of his time.
Course.
Like the amount of money and the way that he's changed like EA's directives and everything to just be entirely money, well not entirely, but very much money focused. Mm. You know, that's great. It ticks a lot of boxes on the business side, but they lose a lot of their identity. Like EA don't have a face at all, other than the corporate guy.
Somebody pointed out really interestingly, to judge a game's creative investment, check out their most shared user interface. Because you'll find there are some companies out there, like Activision, EA, and whatnot, actually do use a homogenized user face.
Rockstar did for so long.
So like when you press pause, it will always look the same no matter what game you're in. Like all the Assassin's Creed games use that.
When they changed it, everyone was like, what is this? But then they've had that for the last two games.
And it's so funny because EA, if you look at, say, like Battlefront 1, the first Star Wars reboot that they did, look at that menu. That's what it was. It was cold.
Yeah.
It was like minimalized. And that's what people see the company.
That's a DICE thing, though. They go for heavy minimalism. And I mean, of course I like that.
I know.
Got a Windows Phone, have you? No.
But it's funny, isn't it? Because it's shared across so many games. Yeah. You end up thinking that you're playing the same game as a result.
That's almost like a group effort to give it an identity or a recognizability that you... I don't know how much that comes from an individual saying, like, oh, the menu should look like this, as opposed to, like, an overall creative decision. But, like,
I don't know, it kind of all
falls together, though.
I'll tell you what, I miss interesting menu options. Yeah. Do you remember in, like, Tomb Raider when she used to get out the map and then it used to zoom in on that?
I'm a big fan. Firewatch has that, too.
The Division and their initial, like, E3 menus, like all the sort of the watch stuff and the holograms and all this sort of thing.
Oh, who can forget the old GoldenEye one just looking into a watch? That was great.
Spencer had some of that too.
But that would have been a crazy decision. At some point, somebody would have come up and said to them, this is what it means to make you feel invested in the game.
I feel like it's because games matured. Like when you look back at, we're going into full technical like user interface stuff.
Yeah.
Like when you go back and look at older games, the UI can sometimes be the most like over the top, like stupid looking thing. Mm-hmm. And like the sort of more sleek, the more serious approach to it nowadays, it shows that sort of maturity. But yeah, I see what you mean by it all becoming the same homogenized sort of thing.
Yeah.
When you look at something like when you look at DICE, things are all very minimalist. You look at Wolfenstein, that goes all Futura for everything. It's like they go super duper minimalist, and it does lose that little bit of identity.
Yeah. But it is extremely usable.
Oh yeah, that's the thing. It's super usable. It's like, for example, no one ever seems to mention the shift in Call of Duty from Modern Warfare 2 to Black Ops 1 when they stopped showing a line of bullets on your screen and actually showed you a number.
That
changed up everything. Whenever I go back to an older game before Black Ops and see that I can't tell how many bullets I've got left without counting it.
See, at some point, they would have had to have that conversation where it's like, okay, we're getting bigger, we're going to serve a wider fan base or a wider potential player base, so they lose the thing that makes it an identifiable factor of those earlier games.
And actually, weirdly, just to loop back into last week's podcast, that kind of comes into accessibility as well.
Yeah.
Because if it's simple, it's easy to look at, then it's, you know, it can help.
Yeah.
Well, I understand the loss of identity through that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, in the most basic game design terms, the most simple game is arguably the best game because it achieves 100% of its core principles of this is the game, this is how you play it, and if the understanding and ability to play between those two points is the shortest, then it's the best game.
That's the perfect segue back into the indie scene as well, because I was going to say, like, how much do you both think that, like, how much do you expect monetization now in video games?
I dread it. to be honest.
But you expect it.
I think it's because it's so prevalent in the industry that there were even games like with Sekiro. I immediately thought to myself, please don't put DLCs.
Until launch, we didn't know.
Yeah, we didn't know. Like, we didn't know at all.
That's why everyone's so skeptical because I like Division's.
Yeah, totally.
And like, and now I'm fine with it if they want to patch in sort of DLC expansion stuff. That's fine. I understand that games adding in extra.
I will pay money to kill the final boss. Let me do that. I'm kidding.
I'll tell you what, Resident Evil 2 is in my good books, right? It is a fantastic remake. They've done so well. But interestingly enough, Capcom announced, I believe it was a couple of days ago, a golden key that you could buy for $4.99.
Just does everything.
And it's things like that. It's like, that monetization didn't need to be
that for me is them selling you a cake and then eating it too or whatever, because they're like, okay, like all the fans who got it up front, they get to have the experience, they unlock it, they feel rewarded. We're not mentioning the unlock all key. And then a few months later, because we're not actively playing Resi 2 anymore, they go, okay, for the rest of you guys who just want to see it all, quote unquote, then we'll let you pay your way through it. And they sort of get to do both sides. It was the same way Konami turned on the microtransactions for Metal Gear Solid 5 and changed the rates so that like you actually couldn't maintain your mother base unless you paid real money or whatever, after the review period had ended. But that idea of expecting monetization, like we don't in indie games, and it would be kind of frowned upon if they, you know, they did it, but that would be good business. If you had something like Celeste, like it has a really good assist mode and all these awards and everything, but I would be really, it would be weird if Matt Thorson, the creative director, suddenly decided to put a monetization element into Celeste, even though it would make good business sense. And it's that back and forward that like some companies indulge in, and how much does that affect like the likability of it or the identity?
I think there's
it.
Just companies that really are very like they stand very strong on that opinion that they're not going to do that, like CD Projekt Red. Like when they did the E3 teaser for Cyberpunk, when it had like all the DOS stuff, or you could read into all the fine print of all the DOS stuff, and they were like absolutely slamming the rest of the industry for various practices, and then kind of people just go, we're not going to do it.
Well, I mean, another
it makes more business sense, but we're not going to do it.
Yeah, another new example as well is The Outer Worlds, like Obsidian's new RPG. They were doing one of those like rapid fire questions with Game Informer, and they said, are there going to be any microtransactions? And they said, hell no. And it's just like, it is. I don't know if it's, that's the thing. Is it an old school mentality?
Yeah, but then they went and put it on the Epic Game Store, didn't they?
Well, it's a product for another podcast. not this day.
Yeah, it's very, very strange, that one. I'm just trying to think of any indie game that has done it and sort of received a backlash. I mean, well, I guess the closest you could say is Payday 2.
Maybe?
That has probably the most DLC I've ever seen. But then again, at that time, fans didn't really care because
it wasn't oversaturated. Yeah. If you look at something like Team Fortress 2 or CS:GO, which I personally believe CS:GO was one of the first to introduce the sort of loot box system. Again, you know, it's all cosmetic. That's a conversation for another time. Yep. But like, they were the first people to do it. Team Fortress did it, and I played a hell of a lot of Team Fortress 2, and I have sunk a lot of money into that game. Getting my crap, getting my banana hat,
I want my fancy
hat to bits. Yeah. Uh-huh. It's like they did that first, and no one really thought much of it because when you actually, you know, they did it first time. Like when you look at it from the outset, does it change the game? No. Does it make them a lot of money? Yes. But because this was a new thing at the time, it wasn't as much frowned upon because it wasn't oversaturated.
Well, even in EA's case, like, I mean, they had random card packs and football card packs and loot boxes and stuff back in 2000. It's called 2006/7 UEFA Champions League. That was like the debut of those kind of like character packs and stuff, footballer packs. But again, we didn't really like kick up that much of a fuss about it because it's like, oh, well, we get foil cards in real life or whatever.
It's like buying Avatar costumes on the Xbox 360 store, which I did.
And it's like, but that's the thing, like, as the industry's gotten bigger and those budgets have inflated, like, how much is it a necessary evil, quote-unquote, to have these recurrent spending methods in there? Obviously, EA mandate it. They're going to have it in a single-player game regardless. Not necessarily in Jedi Fallen Order, because it was started in development before they acquired it, but that's the whole thing. Is like, you know, is it something that we can accept because that, you know, it's just, well, the budget is this big, it's been going on for this long.
That was the excuse before of like, oh, the budget's massive and you're not paying any more for the game than you would be for a game 10 years ago, therefore we kind of need more money,
because the counterpoint to that is that it should be planned better from the beginning.
Again, I come back to that, it's not up to me to pay back your costs,
right?
Exactly. Like I will buy a game if I want to play your game. I won't buy it out of guilt to support it's really bizarre. If it's an indie game and I believe in the developer or the development house, sometimes I will buy a game to support.
Absolutely.
I have 5 copies of Shovel Knight. I will buy it again.
And that's the thing, like, I will gladly support that, but I won't if I am told that the figures and the excess that you're spending on this
are being brought back to us.
You said to us, like, we've raised $500 million on Kickstarter and we're putting it in here, and it's that, like, okay, cool, you don't need any more of my money then.
Fair.
Like, you don't,
it's
like,
very rare that you'll see a Kickstarter project then have a recurrent spending model. It's more something like an Anthem that's like, you know, the development was all over the place and they, you know, they put a model in to get it back later.
I hate to say it, but it's like you sink 60 quid into a game nowadays if you buy it brand new. And we're lucky. We work in an industry where we get given review copies, and it means that for the most part, between us, one of us won't have to pay for it at least.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like, we shouldn't have to spend all this money to keep updating the game. I don't know. I'm just an old man when it comes to this.
No, but that's the thing, though. I think it's the clash of mentalities. And I didn't broach this to have a defined conclusion because I just think it's an interesting talking point. But that's the thing. Like, yeah, how acceptable can recurrent spending methods be? And based on, you know, a development, if a development went awry and they didn't, you know, they actually didn't plan for it, then is it more okay to put those things in?
We overspent 100 million on this game, therefore we're charging 75 quid for it. Rather than 60.
To be honest, I feel like if you are really open and honest about it at the very, very start of the game's development, say, like, look, it's a card trading game where you will be encouraged to buy packs.
I mean, look at Artifact, as much as it fell on its ass. From the outside, it's like, we're a trading card game.
Yeah,
you know what to expect. We're charging you 15 quid for it.
Yeah.
It's this cheap because you need to put more money
and
in.
That's why I agree with that model. If you go for a lower price of entry point and then you can add as much microtransaction stuff on as you want, because you've already stated from the off this is a game that will be better with additional,
and I think
or
that's
even more so if it's free.
Look
at Apex. Yeah.
Literally, I was going to say, free. I think Apex is the nexus of all that, because
Apex is making bank.
It's been received very positively. Like, you can, you know, the barrier for entry is obviously extremely low. You can just play it, and you know, it all goes from there. It tends to be that again, though. It comes back to the identity of the project, and like, if you can have a face guiding that stuff or explaining it to the public or whatever. But to bring it all full circle, like, there's so many elements as to why a developer or a publisher doesn't just do the thing that the fans want, because it might not necessarily be monetizable.
I mean, just, I was going to mention this right at the beginning, but just to drop a specific name on the idea of what the fans want, look at something like Shenmue 3.
Yeah.
Got Kickstarter backed, and then it got announced, and What's-His-Face came on stage at E3 and everyone shat themselves.
Yep.
And
forget his name, but yep.
Yeah.
Yu Suzuki, I think.
Yeah, Yu Suzuki. Uh-huh. And then it's like, everyone's really concerned about this game, because it's like, yes, it's a fan service game, but that's not always a good thing.
Yeah.
When you look at, like, movies, when you look at things like Suicide Squad, it's like, this film was made for the fans,
literally by the trailer company.
Literally, it's like, that all that tells me is this is gonna be really bad, and you're making some rubbish excuse as to why it's bad. It's only meant to cater for certain people. And so, yeah, making stuff that the fans would want specifically, I get. Something as big as like Diablo Immortal as an example, like, there, the backlash that was given to that, I think, was completely justified.
Because no
same
fan
with Command and Conquer.
It, yeah.
Yeah, no fan wanted it. It's like, you're just blatantly, I mean, the idea, you know, oh, you don't have phones. Like, the idea of getting those kind of games on a mobile is kind of fantastic.
Yeah.
Like, having that, when they announced Elder Scrolls Blades, which is apparently, from what I've heard, it's actually pretty,
I'm playing that,
it's
yeah, it's solid. It's fine.
So it's like,
very microtransaction heavy though.
I mean, yeah, of course it will be. But it's like, to take that sort of extra box on the side, that's fine. But to do it entirely to replace something, then yeah, that is something that is against what the fans would want. Mm.
I think it might be another topic to expand in another podcast, but I think there's that weird, like, silent majority that, like, do, you know, like, Fallout 76 still ended the charts, Anthem still ended the charts. All these games that, like, the vast majority of us turn our noses up for whatever reasons, based on how long we've been gaming or whatever it is, like, there is that silent majority that will pay microtransactions, like, whether it comes from a whale, as they call them, like some business executive with a few thousand pounds to
or
spare.
Just people that like playing the game.
Yeah, or people that grew up with microtransactions. I mean, there was a horror story of a friend of mine whose little cousin was playing something and turned around and died in, I think it was in Mario, and just said, oh, where do I buy more lives? Just assumed that it was in there, and it's like, oh, they've got their tendrils in. Like, if they convince the, you know, if it's out there enough, then a newer generation will grow up assuming microtransactions are the norm.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's this weird bygone thing that a full game was given to you for a price. So yeah, gonna leave everyone on that particularly horrifying note. But for now, this has been the What Culture Gaming Podcast. I've been your host, Scott Tailford, and you can find us all on the Twitters. But for now, I've been joined by Rich Hudson.
Thank you for listening. You can follow me on Twitter at PickupChangeToe.
And Jules Gill.
Thank you very much for having me. You can follow me at RetroJ with a zero. But before we end, I just want to say, you can play whatever you want.
Yes.
You can like whatever you like, and you can dislike whatever you like. It is completely up to you what you spend your money on. Don't let three very white, very nerdy men tell you what to think, all right? Because otherwise, we're just EA.
Yeah, but go play Shovel Knight.
Go play Shovel Knight.
Yeah. Bye.
Goodbye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.